This podcast contains explicit language.
So that happened. This week, Donald Trump said some crazy stuff, but what does it matter? The people that could deliver him the nomination want the crazy, and everyone else can't seem to stop him. So how do you solve a problem like Donald Trump? And who caused it? We've got guests who will do their best. Wisconsin Republican Congressman Reid Ribble and writer and podcaster Anna Marie Cox. Meanwhile, Democrats Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders seem to want to have a serious debate over the future of the Democratic Party. So why doesn't the Democratic Party want anyone to watch it? Can Clinton's plan to rein in Wall Street immunize her against the charges that she's under their thumb? Also, Martin O'Malley will be there. Finally, Congress needs to pass an omnibus funding bill to keep government from shutting down again. Last time we did this, some big banks used leverage to make off with some of your money and paid no price for this extortion. So guess what's happening this time? Just guess. I'm Jason Linkins with Huffington Post reporters Zach Carter, Arthur Delaney, Samantha Lockman, and Shaheen Nasirapour. But here's what happened first. Hey, everybody. Once again, it is Friday, I suppose. That's when this happens. And it's the So That Happened podcast with your pals. I'm one of your pals, Jason Linkins. I'm the editor of Eat the Press. Thank you. Thank you. That was very Woo! Nice.
That was a fast
clap. We have a really great show for you today. And I'm here with two of my best friends in the world.
Aw.
Yeah, you're my best friends. You're my
Better
only friends.
Be. I do this shit with you every week.
I know. Well, not doing it with me every week. Only on special weeks, we have Samantha Lockman.
Hey.
You might remember her from Canada. And we have Zach Carter.
Hey!
You might remember him from that painful thing you endured.
What did I do?
I don't know. So we have a week ahead of us. This is one of those odd ones where we take So That Happened and we force it into the future tense because we're weird and we don't give a shit about time.
We can defeat time.
Yep.
With our metaphysical powers.
Temporal reality. And Arthur Delaney's out sick, so we can like completely break the fourth wall in time. It's Thursday, maybe, but maybe it's not. Who knows? It could be Saturday. Whenever you're listening to it, that's when it is.
Now is now, man. You know?
Probably nothing has changed by the time they're
Probably
listening.
Probably not. Now is now, and now is also then, and then is now. So what's coming up in a week's time is we have two debates because God has decided to punish us. So
God being the DNC.
Yes, and the RNC. DNC God. In particular.
DNC in particular.
This we're is gonna, a very bad deity. This
yeah, we're going to focus. So we're focusing on the front runners in each party. A little bit later, we'll talk about the congealed ball of raven shit that is running the at the top of the
by congealed ball of raven shit, Jason means Donald Trump. For right. those of you who are not following closely,
yes. And so now we're going to talk about the Democratic debate and Hillary Clinton. Democratic debate's on Saturday,
December 19th,
because the DNC wants Hillary Clinton to win.
Yes,
it's Who's- really.
Who's going to, like...
That's the conspiracy theory, anyway.
This is what I wonder is how cynical you have to be about your party and your party's ideas that you don't want anyone to watch them debating. Because they don't... It's not like they look bad when they're debating. They actually look pretty good,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
And it's like, we're going to put this on to Saturday, December 19th, when the entire nation is wasted at their holiday party, eating their Franks and grape jelly and chili.
The amazing cocktail Frank recipe.
Which I just learned about.
Yes.
So no one will watch this debate.
I just changed your life.
I'm disgusted and I'm going nowhere near that. So we will not be at a holiday party. We will be watching the Democratic debate on Saturday, December 19th.
I actually signed a deal where I only had to cover the last weekend debate. So I won't be
watching
the
wow.
Democratic debate. So it's glad we're talking about it. It is kind of curious because, like you said, Donald Trump has lent this weird hallucinatory aspect to the Republican debates where you never know what the fuck's going to happen or who he's going to insult or what path he's going to take everyone down.
Or how all the other people respond to open fascist demagoguery from Donald Trump.
Right.
Will they say, well, you know, I would like to be a kinder, gentler fascist, or I don't want to criticize this fascist next to me. He's a nice man, which is what happens all the time at every debate. They refuse to criticize the guy. It's crazy.
Meanwhile, on the Democratic side, there's a legitimately interesting thing going on that liberals and from the center out to the far left should be paying attention to, because you have a genuinely institutional supporting candidate in Hillary Clinton, whose belief is that the system is mostly working, it just needs a few tweaks, and a sort of revolutionary style candidate in Bernie Sanders, who believes the system has failed and needs to be replaced wholesale. That's a pretty cool debate. And the two of them typically go back and forth with each other in a thoughtful, classy manner. They seem to understand that there's a certain amount of reverence that should be had toward this. So the Democrats do look good comparatively when they're debating compared to the Republicans. But for some reason, the DNC doesn't want you to ever see that. So,
yeah. I mean, in the number of viewers tells the story, like each Republican debate brought in like what, like 24 million people, 23 million people,
yeah.
Like crazy record smashing numbers. But the Democratic debates was only like, you know,
yeah.
Way, way less. And obviously this one will be, it'll, and then it'll be embarrassing for the party because Republicans will be able to say like, oh, look, only 2 million people watch your debate.
Okay.
That looks bad
for you. I also want to point out this strategically, just the management here from the DNC, even if you are trying to put a fix in for Hillary Clinton, this is the worst way to do it.
Yeah.
Because all this does is result in a lot of primetime television for Republican candidates who then become celebrities. And let's face it, people vote. I mean, one of the reasons Donald Trump is popular in the Republican Party is because he's a guy they know.
Yeah.
They've seen him on TV before. The fewer times you put your candidates on TV to present their ideas, the fewer chances you have for that candidate to make that pitch to the country. And I mean, particularly with Hillary Clinton, it's not like she's a bad debater. She does pretty well in these things usually.
Yeah, she's good.
Unbelievably bad strategy from the DNC on this.
And totally.
Obviously, there's some dissent within the ranks of the Democratic Party.
Well, you know, it's funny. I read what passed for the DNC autopsy from the 2014 elections, and it wasn't much. It wasn't as nearly as searing or as reaching as what the RNC did with their own autopsy. But there's still, I think, too much of a sense that the Democrats think they can skate, pointing out that the other side is crazy and not filling the space with ideas. And this debate strategy reflects it. They believe, hey, the more Americans see how dumb the Republicans are, they'll turn to us. But us are a bunch of people who keep themselves sequestered and out of sight and keep whatever, I don't know if they even have ideas beyond what's been debated, but they keep their ideas hidden and off the shelf and out of reach. And we're going to go, but we're going to talk about something that did happen in terms of that. Hillary Clinton actually did, in a news cycle that kind of, it was against the run of play as far as the news cycle goes. We were all talking about terrorism, and Hillary Clinton put an op-ed out about her plan to rein in Wall Street. So what do we think about that plan?
Well, I don't even know if Samantha and I agree on this.
Cool, let's have a fight.
We may agree, we may disagree. I find her plan to be, look, all of these policy proposals that Democrats are putting out, they have no chance of passing because there's going to be a Republican Congress
right.
at the end of whenever these people are elected.
Or a Republican House,
right.
at least.
There will be a way that makes it very difficult for something to be implemented.
Right, right, right.
So to some extent, this is a signaling game for the public to say, this is where I stand. Here's how I think about the world. Not so much to say, here are the policies that I will actually implement. And so what I've found interesting about Hillary Clinton's proposal, and her op-ed basically rehashes a proposal she's put out before, is that she's taking a couple of ideas. They're not terrible ideas. Like, she wants to tax high-frequency trading. Mm-hmm. High-frequency trading
is Elizabeth Warren, in fact, supports parts of this plan.
Yes. Well, look, there's really nothing in the plan that's not worth supporting. The plan has plenty.
I have one thing.
Plan has plenty of good stuff, but what it doesn't do is change the financial system in any significant way.
Right. This is an op-ed in the New York Times from earlier this week. We should have said
that.
Yeah.
And she was giving a speech about it, right? She gave and I believe you covered that, right?
Yeah, she's been rolling out each one of those things sort of separately. So some of this stuff was new stuff, and some of it she's been talking about for a while. So
yeah, but for the most part, this is she is not talking about fundamentally changing the financial system, and she kind of goes out of her way to say, in the op-ed in particular, she says, you know, if we just look at the banks and break up the banks, then we're not going to deal with all the problems in the shadow banking sector.
Right.
We're not going to deal with AIG and Lehman Brothers. And this is a straw man argument, because people who say break up the banks, they don't mean only banks that are chartered as commercial banks
mm-hmm.
that are regulated by the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. That is a very narrow definition of what banking is. Nobody who wants to break up the banks says, you know what, AIG should be allowed to do whatever they want, and that will be my plan.
Right,
that
right,
makes sense. So she is going out of her way to say, I don't want to deal with the obvious antitrust problems in the banking sector. And then by saying, I don't want to break up the banks, she then just says, and by the way, I also am going to regulate these other companies that are dangerous, but I won't break them up. And then she tries to wear that as like some badge of toughness for Wall Street, which I find basically deceptive. She's claiming to do something tough, and people who understand finance can look at it and say, oh, she's not actually going to change things very much.
Right. I think it's interesting, your argument, because it's sort of like she's portraying this is Glass-Steagall, which her husband repealed in 1999, right? Mm-hmm. So which, you know, separated the commercial investment activities of banks for decades.
The wall. There's no separation after it repealed it.
Right, yeah. Exactly. And so she's portraying it as this mutually exclusive thing. Like, oh, if we reinstated Glass-Steagall, we wouldn't be able to do all these other things. And this isn't – and she also says, well, like, this isn't what caused the financial crisis, so we shouldn't reinstate it. But there's all these other good arguments to make about why it is a good idea to reinstate it. So it's
the idea that it did not cause the financial crisis is the idea that, like, you know, the Big Bang didn't cause the financial crisis. Like,
right.
Yeah, like lots of stuff, causality happens.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
But I mean, look, Citibank failed in the financial crisis. It completely fell apart and it got bailed out. Citibank was the bank that lobbied to get Glass-Steagall repealed so that it could become bigger. So you can say Glass-Steagall was not the fundamental driving force, but there's no way you can argue that things didn't get worse because these banks were doing mega mergers with other investment companies and mixing up their stuff. It just doesn't make sense.
I'm sure I've pointed this out before on the show, but Sandy Weill, who was the head of Citibank at the time, they were lobbying against Glass-Steagall, and who for years bragged about being the guy who broke Glass-Steagall.
Shattered it.
Shattered Glass-Steagall. Yeah. He's now gone on record thinking that, you know, there should be some sort of firewall between commercial investment banks. I don't know why we don't have one. I'm Sandy Weill, super genius. There is a thing, actually, that I find objectionable in Hillary Clinton's financial plan. Da, 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 da.
Let's hear it.
Okay, and it's the risk fee plan. To me, it's one of those ideas, much like, hey, people on the no-fly list shouldn't have guns, that sounds great until you dig into it and start thinking about it. To me, the whole idea that the banks are going to pay into a risk fee, pay a risk fee to the government, I feel like banks are going to come to think of that as capitalization in another name. That is to say that they're paying the risk fee.
So they can do whatever they want.
Yeah, so let's get loose and loose with the risk. I feel like that's the wrong message to be sending in an age where it's so hard to break too big to fail banks down into something that's small enough to fail. And I think that Clinton, in suggesting this risk fee plan, is promising something. It's a real false dawn to my mind. I think that's going to be taken the wrong way. And I think that, God help us if we ever get in a position where what happened in 2008 happens again. But I think a lot of people are going to be clamoring, what about the risk fee? What about the risk fee? Oh, well, guess what? That was the thing that incentivized this new round of gauche
gambling. Well, look, here's the deal. If you did a risk fee that was really high and really severe and said, look, if your assets are more than 3% of the American economy or something, then you have to pay $1 trillion every year. Make it so bad, make that fee so punishing that banks voluntarily break themselves up and say, you know, I don't want to do that. I don't want to pay that fee. Mm-hmm. It makes more sense for me to be split into smaller pieces, and our shareholders of these multiple companies will make more money than a shareholder of one company. Then that's a good plan. The thing is, if that's your ultimate plan, to break up the banks, why wouldn't you just say, I want to break up the banks?
Right.
You say you want to do a risk fee because you don't want that to happen. You're saying, you know,
Want it to be just a slap on, like, something really small that wouldn't change their behavior in any way.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Which tends to be what we do to them, is we have these little slaps. You know, ooh, bat, you were bad. Don't do that again.
Right.
Don't want another slap. And the banks are like, I don't want another slap.
Yeah.
Definitely. Definitely, yeah. Don't slap me again.
Yeah, and her plan is just proposing stuff that Democrats have floated before, like legislation they've introduced. And as Zach said, it's never going anywhere. So I guess I totally agree with that point. I don't disagree with you at all. So. All right.
Same team. Wow.
Yeah. No fight.
Agreement.
Community of trust.
So let's move on to the GOP debate, which was happening sooner than the Democrats.
Tuesday.
On a weeknight when people will watch it.
Yep, people will watch it. And by the way, they've added another debate to the schedule the RNC has. So
in January.
Yeah, so...
It's funny the RNC seems to think that having more debates is good because they keep adding them. It's weird that they think that getting their candidates on TV is going
to
help
them.
And
that goes against their autopsy where they said we need to do fewer debates and they keep adding them.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the idea behind adding debates is trying to give people a chance to reassert themselves against Donald Trump running roughshod over the party. We're talking about Donald a lot in this podcast, so I want to try to talk about some of the people who've positioned themselves into place. I think that we can definitively say now that the non-Trump candidate in the catbird seat is Ted Cruz, right?
Yeah.
No doubt.
And that's why he won't say anything negative about Trump.
Right, right.
Because he's trying to make Trump supporters come to him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, it's I got to say, I've watched a lot of Republican primaries and watched a lot of Republican primary debates, and they're not actually a place for the profile and courage to thrive. No, they're not. I mean, Rick Perry, it was 4 years ago that Rick Perry tried to stand up for what it means to be the governor of a border state and having to have a responsible, humane immigration platform. It's very courageous. He took it right to his opponents, and he got his eyes dug out with spoons for his trouble. So Ted Cruz in not objecting.
That was incredibly graphic.
Thank you. Thank you. It's literally what happened. No, I'm just kidding. It's figuratively what happened. He said at one point,
if you want to deny kids college, like kids who just came here through no fault of their own, college access to college, then I think you don't have a heart. And he got booed for it on stage.
So Ted Cruz, I'm not surprised that he's saying, oh, well, you know, Donald Trump, I don't really have an objection to his craziness. But it does create an opportunity maybe for somebody else. What do you have to do? We've seen so many people just flop and fail on this stage. Rand Paul went from being the most interesting man in politics, according to Time.
So angry.
Time Magazine, I don't know if they would know interesting if it came up in you know. fill in the blank.
If it jumped up and bit him.
But he completely fell apart. Jeb Bush completely, I think Jeb Bush's his campaign, I've said it before, I think it's one of the historic cock-ups in campaign history.
Definitely. Spent so many millions of dollars to do worse than when they were at, where they were at months ago.
Yeah.
It's one of the things, like, look, money in politics is destroying everything, and it's really bad, and it's a huge problem, and it's corruption, but it is also funny when people, rich people, spend lots and lots and lots of money on a candidate like Jeb Bush, who is a complete failure.
Jeb Bush spent months, like, officially not being a candidate to raise all this money with his super PAC. Like, what? They raised, like, more than $100 million or something like that?
And I think Mike Murphy sits up in the office and just lights it on fire.
Right. There was a great story today about how they spent, like, half of that money already, and he's, like, significantly lower in the polls than he was before. Yeah. So that's kind of funny. Like, it's a nice irony of the whole thing that makes us feel better about campaign finance.
I always say about the primary season is that they are a smorgasbord for failure junkies. The only bad thing about the primary season is that eventually someone succeeds, and that's the worst.
But until then, we're so excited about when people are going to drop out.
But this primary has been amazing. Like, I drink the tears of Jeb Bush fans like it was tap water, and it's so delicious. It's stunning. These are the people that funded, who came around and in the old way of doing campaign finance, put his brother into office.
Yeah,
and they've completely lost the thread this year.
But look, here's the thing: the reason they're getting their butts kicked this year is because they've also fueled this incredibly angry, hostile, vaguely white nationalist.
Not vaguely white nationalist, like
fairly explicitly white nationalist.
White nationalist base in the Republican Party. And Donald Trump is just feeding off of that. And so people have been saying he's gonna goof up, he's gonna say something that's too extreme.
Nothing at this point.
For that core of Republican voters, they don't care. They want to hear him say nasty stuff because they agree with it. And that's what the party has been stoking for decades now. So the idea that someone is going to be able to counter him by standing up and saying, you know what, I'm a good Republican, but damn it, I just can't take all this racist crap that Donald Trump is spewing anymore, that doesn't work because a lot of the Republican Party is just really into racist crap. That is just a clear fact that Donald Trump is laying bare by his continued popularity, despite opening his campaign by calling Mexicans rapists and then continuing this week saying we should ban Muslims, even if they're American citizens, from coming back into the country.
Well, they're like the independents who vote in a general for a Republican, like, may like someone standing up to him now, but it's not the people who are voting in Iowa and New Hampshire or whatever. It just depends on
that's dry powder.
Yeah.
As far as what could happen right now, primaries are happening, and the people that would normally restore sense to this hot dish, they're not showing up until November, and then God knows where
they are. It's too late.
And so these debates, there's an opportunity for people to say, hey, we're not cool with your fascist demagoguery, Donald Trump. And I will give you, I'll bet there is one guy who tries to do that on stage. I bet he gets booed and nobody else does it after that. That is my prediction.
Well, like Kasich kind of did that last time, so it'll be him.
I'll bet it's him.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, John Kasich, good luck.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, we're back, and I'm back with Zach Carter, as normal.
Woo! Good times.
Don't talk about the tent, Zach.
I've already come out of the tent today. I'm out and about in the world, you know.
Okay, cool. Great. And thank God we have a normal human being on with us. Over the phone is Shaheen Nasirapour, Huffington Post angry financial reporter.
Chief financial and regulatory reporter, right?
Thanks for having me on, guys. What an introduction. I'm a normal human being.
Isn't that great to hear about?
We used to joke around in the office that Shaheen was so entranced by money and numbers that he had trouble dealing with the humans, and humans was always spelled with a Z in our office emails about it. I don't know if that's going to make the final podcast, but it's a great way to understand Shaheen.
Everything that doesn't make the final podcast could make the podcast of blackmail that Adriana is producing even as we speak. So we've got a bunch of interesting stuff to talk about. Zach, set the table for us.
So Congress needs to pass legislation in order to prevent the federal government from shutting down.
Wait, we're back to this again?
This seems to happen often now. It didn't happen 7 years ago, but it happens now pretty much every year.
Oh, the fuck.
And last year, there was a big problem with this because nobody wanted the government to shut down, but Wall Street wanted to get subsidies for risky derivatives trading. Derivatives are the complex financial contracts at the heart of the 2008 meltdown. And they literally wanted federal government subsidies for this trading, which ordinary people would think of and say, well, that's crazy. You shouldn't do that. But Congress said, okay. And they put this into the bill, and then the government almost shut down because people said, hey, we can't go along with you can't hijack this process by which the federal government gets funded.
Just to hand money to Wall Street
right.
for no good reason.
So they can... what Wall Street learned from this was that you should do that
all
every
the time.
Year. Because it works and you get more money. But it has changed a little bit this year, and it's something I kind of want to talk with Shaheen about. the provisions in the they're calling it the omnibus spending bill are much narrower than the provisions of subsidizing all derivatives trading. It's basically a very targeted subsidy at two private equity companies, Apollo Capital Management and TPG, that own a casino called Caesars, which is, it's not just Caesars Palace in Las Vegas. It's a fairly broad casino empire all over the United States.
Render unto Caesars.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of pun potential in this.
A lot
one.
Of pun potential. Yeah.
So what they're going to do? There's this provision that's being pushed now by Richard Shelby and Harry Reid, which would essentially change the 1939 Trust Indenture Act to make it easier for Apollo and TPG to exact concessions from their bondholders, people who own debt in this company, in order to just essentially let them rewrite the contract so they don't get paid what they thought they were going to get paid, and give shareholders much more leverage over other parties to debt deals going forward. And there are potential long-term consequences for this. But the interesting thing is that that's not why it's being driven. It's being driven because people just want to give Apollo and TPG some money for Christmas. And I guess I wanted to ask Shaheen, do you feel like, I felt like we talked about this a few months ago, and it seemed like the temperature had sort of changed in Washington about how we help Wall Street just sort of arbitrarily. But to me, it seems like there's something different here, where we're trying instead of messing with Dodd-Frank or something. Like, maybe people got the message you're not supposed to mess with Dodd-Frank, and they're just trying to find other ways to do things. Like, what do you make of it, Shaheen?
You know, it's funny. You and I were talking about this recently privately in terms of how the tide appeared to be shifting in favor of creditors and lenders in Washington, where, you know, you had this horrendous financial crisis, you had the Great Recession, country still recovering very slowly, and now you have lawmakers wanting to basically turn the screws on borrowers, right, where they're making it harder for borrowers to basically recover from the crisis. Yet when it comes to companies, Congress is bending over backwards to give them concessions, all in the name of job creation and spurring the recovery, with like no evidence that either one of those things will happen if they continue to give these corporate handouts to companies that, frankly, if they were healthy and if they were hiring, they wouldn't need special favors from Washington, right? They'd have a product or a service that people would pay for, and they could hire more folks, and there'd be demand, and it would be this virtuous cycle. Instead, you have companies that are kind of on the brink of bankruptcy, like, for example, Caesars, the gaming company, or EDMC, the for-profit school chain. They go to their friends in Washington. They ask for help. There's, like, no hesitation to help them. Whereas when it comes to, like, American consumers and borrowers, there's, like, no relief coming from this Congress. And the disconnect to me is striking. And I'm almost kind of appalled by just the lack of overall attention being paid to this phenomenon.
So to be clear, what this provision would do, essentially Caesars is on the verge of bankruptcy. And the people who support it say, look, going to bankruptcy is bad and bad things can happen in bankruptcy. So we want to create a situation in which the shareholders, who in this case are private equity companies, Apollo Capital Management and TPG, can work out a deal with the existing debt that the other people who own that debt are. And by keeping them out of bankruptcy, which is a very big, scary word, this will prevent thousands of people from being laid off at casinos all over the country. That's not necessarily what happens when somebody files for bankruptcy, right, Shaheen? I mean, something when you file for bankruptcy, you're working out debt. That doesn't immediately mean that your company's operations shut down, right?
That's correct. If all a bankruptcy is it's a reorganization of your debts. The debts that you can pay off, there's a schedule created, you make payments. The debts that you can't pay off, your creditors will basically write it off or they'll amend the terms of those agreements. I mean, Caesars, if they were to declare bankruptcy, I'm not aware of any evidence that they would immediately shut down and thousands of Nevada jobs would be lost.
But what would happen is that the shareholders would immediately take a big hit. And the shareholders in this case are Apollo Capital Management and TPG. Just to be clear, those are the two companies who are benefiting from this provision.
Right. It's not like, and there's no guarantee you're going to save these jobs anyway at all.
Well, look.
Correct.
I mean, we go back to the auto bailouts and the argument over who takes the haircut. To my mind, and I'm sorry if people think this is, you know, I'm being a Leninist here, but to my mind,
I hope not.
If a big business fails, the people who take the haircut are the idiots who'd invested in that business. Y'all made the wrong bet. You don't punish the people who showed up to do the job. The people who showed up to do the job didn't have a chance to make a decision. They didn't have a chance to say, don't put a fucking ugly tail fin on this car. No one will buy it. They just did it because that's what they got paid to do. But some dipshit said, yeah, we need to make these fucking cars again and again and again, even though no one buys them. Those are the guys who obviously deserve to take the hit.
And
I don't really have... Who's losing their shirt? These are all rich people. They make one bet, it goes bad. They're still allowed to make other ones.
And the thing is, you end up, if they make this change to the law, you end up with a situation in which the people who make the risky bets, if you own equity in a company, that's supposed to be the risky position. The debt is supposed to be less risky.
That's the thing these young, dumb capitalists forget about. Risk, man. There's no capitalism without risk. All these people have been trying to iron out the risk for fucking years. The 2008 financial crisis, to my mind, happened because everyone bought this idea that they could just make money forever with no risk attached to it. And guess what wrong?
I mean, Shaheen, have you ever seen this? Every now and then, like, my hackles rise when I see someone saying, yeah, this is a great opportunity for a low-risk, high-yield investment. And that should not exist by definition in finance. If something is risky, it should you get paid more because it's risky, and then with the caveat that you might lose everything, not the other way around.
It's that simple, man. You want to keep things nice and conservative? Bring risk back to capitalism. But I want to – is there anything else going on in this omnibus that we should just be appalled at?
I was just going to say this, the Trust Indenture Act thing, the thing about Caesars and EDMC. So EDMC, Education Management, is for-profit. It's a chain of for-profit schools, art institutes, Argosy, these institutions it's based out of Pittsburgh. The company recently settled federal and state allegations that they defrauded taxpayers out of at least $11 billion over a years-long scheme in which the government alleged they repeatedly lied to the government when they said they were not paying bonuses to their recruiters based on the number of students they enroll. This may not sound like a big deal, but I'll just break it down really quickly. For-profit schools will basically admit anyone. If you can pay, you'll get in, regardless of your qualifications, more or less. So the problem is, and the government realized this, if you pay bonuses to recruiters based on the number of people you enroll, your recruiters are just going to be incentivized to enroll anyone, regardless of their qualifications, regardless if they're going to benefit from the education, regardless if they can repay the student loan debt that they take out in order to pay for classes.
You're just setting up a system where people are paid to set people up to fail, essentially.
Exactly. Exactly. And there's no risk, right? Because it's the students who take on all the risk of the debt, and if they subsequently default, it's their ass on the line. The schools, you know, they'll face, like, some consequences within the first 3 years if borrowers default, but there are ways to gain that and to prolong it where you basically have no risk at all. So anyway, EDMC was alleged to have done this for years, and every year certifying to the federal government that they weren't doing it. Whistleblowers came forward. They said, no, this is happening. We have documents. We have evidence, etc. Anyway, a couple weeks ago, the government settled the case for, like, nothing, less than $100 million. And EDMC will have years to pay this off. So I want to make sure people understand this. Here's a chain of for-profit colleges accused by several states and the Department of Justice of defrauding taxpayers out of at least $11 billion over a years-long crime spree. And here we are a few weeks later, right after they settle those allegations, in which, you know, top government leaders called them like the poster child for for-profit college fraud and abuse. Congress is now going to change a law dating from the Great Depression that will basically reduce that company's costs. And instead of helping the company's former students or its current students who have student loan debt and they probably have no chance of repaying it, Congress isn't trying to help them. They're trying to help this company.
Well, and let's be clear here, Sheen, because there's that is the initial maneuver. But now people are saying in Washington, maybe we can craft this favor because the EDMC stuff is so toxic. Maybe we can do it to carve out EDMC and it'll only apply to Caesars. And won't that be great?
You know, it's so funny because people always love to make the admonition, oh, government should be run like a household. It's like our government robs households. And our government allows Wall Street to be run like a casino. It's like, if you want to take a risk, capitalize yourself, son. Don't be taken by money. Yeah. Sometimes we're not good at our own homespun wisdom, I guess. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. I am back with Arthur Delaney here.
Hello.
And we are very happy to welcome back for the third time our friend, Wisconsin Republican Reed Ribble. Congressman, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. I'm sitting here in my office in Washington, D.C. and staying hard at work.
Well, we've had you on the show a couple times to like dig into the weeds of policy mechanisms and how to reform them. And today we're kind of going to stray away from that and now pull back maybe 30,000 feet in the air to talk about what's going on in sort of general transfer politics. But it wasn't long ago that you referred to reality television mogul Donald Trump as a three-year-old. This was September. So it's December now. He's 3 years and 3 months. How's he wearing on you now?
Well, he hasn't learned much in 3 months. One of the issues with his statement the other day about prohibiting the entrance of any Muslim into the country, the words like that violate the moral conscience of a nation. You know, our first right, our first freedom in the Bill of Rights was the fact that government could not restrict the free expression of religion. One of our founding principles was based on that freedom. And the idea that we would create a religious litmus test in this country is astoundingly offensive to me.
Now, Congressman, Donald Trump has surely gone farther than the others with his call to ban Muslims from traveling here. But there has been talk about, you know, preferences for Christian refugees, for instance, and the tracking of Muslims in the United States. What, you know, how far out is he really from the other Republicans running for president right now?
Well, no, I think he's quite a ways out. I think, let me take the first one that you mentioned, the finding some type of fast track for Christian Muslims that have been under attack by ISIS. When we look at the video of ISIS taking 24, 25 Coptic Christian men and beheading them on a beach someplace, that also shocks our conscience. And we have, throughout our history, stood up for various people groups and religious groups that have come under attack. And we have allowed refugees to come into the country as a response to those attacks. And so I think you can make a bit of a distinction because of the nature and how heinous the crimes have been committed against Christians, particularly in Syria and in Libya. And so I think I can give somewhat of a pass there. I don't give a total pass, but I can give somewhat of a pass there. And on the I can't remember what the second one was. You had to restate the question.
Oh, well, I think that was the most important one we talked about. There was Ben Carson saying he wouldn't accept a Muslim president, but that was kind of like not a very serious moment. Yeah.
I serve in Congress with Muslims.
Absolutely.
And our armed forces have thousands of Muslims defending the nation every single day. We have police officers that are Muslims protecting citizens as they go about their daily work. And let's just talk about King Abdullah from Jordan. He has been a staunch ally in the war against ISIS.
That's true.
And what are we going to say? You can't come to the U.S. and have a meeting with us? I mean, we have to get
We're working so hard to get people who helped us in war theaters as translators over here, protect them from what could happen to them if they're ever found out to have helped us.
That's correct.
So it's a lot. Yeah, it was a very strong denunciation. No minced words there. I one of the things that I keep coming back to is way, way back, and this might have been an idea that Reince Priebus had that felt good and sounded good at the time, because there was a moment where Donald Trump was threatening to brook out and run as an independent. It could be a bluff. It may not be. But Reince Priebus had all the candidates sort of swear fealty to one another. We will support this man if he becomes president. I know that you've said you won't. I wonder if this was a big mistake. If instead of locking Donald Trump to a path to be a Republican, he's locked too many Republicans on a path to being Trump.
Well, yeah, possibly, but I'm still, and I would say, I think I can say this with a lot of confidence, I do not believe that Donald Trump will be the Republican nominee. Now, I could see him running as an independent, and he's kind of reneged on his own agreement not to do that, where he said he's still going to consider it. You know, it's always, well, depending how they treat me and what have you. And so he wants to create the rule system that he wants to create. Whether it was a mistake for them to do that or not, I don't think it's a mistake for any political party to say, listen, if you're going to be running to be the senior leader of our party, you have to be a Republican, you know, and you have to commit to not running against Republicans.
But you do rule out supporting him if he did somehow become the nominee. I agree with you.
My first oath is to the Constitution of the United States. Donald Trump has taken positions contrary to that document, so I could not support him and uphold my oath.
He seems unfamiliar with the Constitution.
He does.
But also he seems unfamiliar with some basic things about Republican politics. You know, religion and libertarianism are core traits of conservatism. And, you know, why hasn't his total lack of any libertarian or religious tendencies dragged him down? Or will it, as this primary drags on?
Well, I think as you look at the size of the field, I think that's part of his mystique, is that the size of the field is so large that Republicans have divvied their votes up, that 65% that don't support Donald Trump are supporting somebody else right now. And as that field starts to thin out and it starts to get serious as we get closer to election days and caucus days in Iowa and in New Hampshire and then on to Super Tuesday, and what have you, you're going to start to see that thin out, and you're going to see what I believe are the real leaders that will emerge and ultimately become the nominee. That's kind of my guess, but he has defied gravity for sure.
Well, you know, it was a fellow Wisconsin Republican, Scott Walker, when he dropped out of the race. His parting words were kind of an admonition of sorts to the rest of the field he was leaving behind, to follow him out of the field. If you were like him, down low in the polls, without a realistic shot at winning the nomination, to sort of self-extract yourself from the field and allow one or two, I don't, for the lack of a better word, we'll call them traditional or establishment candidates, let more of this voting support accrue to one or two candidates who could then better mount a real campaign against Donald Trump. Those may have been the words of wisdom in this race.
They certainly foreshadowed what's going on right now, and I think you can see it in the numbers. Donald Trump has kind of capped out. He's he hasn't moved really much above that 30% number, and he's kind of just stayed right there. On occasion, he'll dip down a little bit or go up a little bit, but his supporters are firm with him, but they're locked there, and he hasn't been able to expand his reach, whereas other candidates, whether it was Ben Carson, Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, they've all are getting their moments to make a run at it.
It's important to remember that all Trump's really got is a plurality of half the electorate. But what, you know, assuming he does eventually flame out somehow, which I think is a smart assumption still, what about those voters? Are they just fans of reality TV who weren't paying attention to Republican politics earlier, or are we going to have this new phenomenon in American politics with this really strong white nativist voting bloc?
Well, I don't think so. I think what you're seeing a little bit with his followers is that these followers have a certain amount of fear factor in them. They're clearly dissatisfied with Washington D.C. and they're very dissatisfied with President Obama. And so they're moving as far away from those positions as they possibly can get. And that in effect, is Donald Trump. He's the anti-establishment or anti-system-based candidate. And they're kind of having a good time being in that space. But at some point, you have to get down to the actual system of governing. And I believe that most voters are going to think long and hard before they mark a box in that ballot box. And like you, I don't think it will ultimately be Mr. Trump as the nominee.
But this is happening in tandem with some other things that clearly affect it, namely these terror attacks. And we have seen public support for actually sending combat troops to the Middle East rise to a majority level. And it seems likely to me that the things are related. Do you think this is just a moment, or is politics changing more permanently because of Trumpism?
I think they're two different questions, quite frankly, because on the first time, the first way you phrased it, you talked about the nativist nature of kind of Donald Trump's predominantly white support. And then here you talked and you brought in a broader view of what does the war on terror look like in 2015 and 2016, and do we need to be more engaged internationally to defeat it? And I think they're two different things. I think they can a bit feed on each other, but you can talk to, and I've got members on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, good friends of mine that are Democrats, that are saying we have to be more engaged in this war on terror and wanting to use our military in a more aggressive nature. And so it's not just kind of this nativist group of folks that you might at first blush think it is.
Do you think Congress is going to get in on this and vote on a war authorization? I believe you are somebody who's amenable to that idea, but it seems like it won't happen.
Well, I think it could happen. I think that what happened in San Bernardino could, in fact, be a game changer to provide the president with an authorization to use military force. We're using some military force already in Syria, but he's doing it absent an authorization. But clearly, there is a sense in the country that things aren't right, that there's more risk here. And should there be another attack like we had in San Bernardino, or even prior to that, if our allied partners in Europe are really engaging, like we're seeing the French and now the Germans do, I think you'll see an uptick of U.S. involvement.
All right. Well, Congressman, thank you for being with us. We really look forward to you being back, and maybe the next time you come back, there'll be a little bit more of a sort of rational frame on the race.
Yeah, we hope so. Thanks much.
Hey guys, we'll get back to the program in just a second. I just wanted to take a minute to welcome all of you into my safe space here, to thank all of you for tuning into the show and helping us to create an Inside the Beltway show for Beltway outsiders and make
there
it a reality.
We are back.
We love hearing from you. Your feedback has been a tremendously good, positive
influence.
It's
so great to be getting out of the tent
every week.
The tent studio
now,
where I live.
You can help other people find out about this show.
You're helping to have you back.
Sleep. If you are an iTunes user, please look for our show.
And we're so happy
subscribe
to have.
If you haven't. And use iTunes
for the third time on our show. And the first time
rate
our
studio,
show,
to leave us a comment.
Honorary Cox.
It will help people
thank
like you,
thank you
find this show.
The original Wonkat is
written for every magazine
going
ever created.
Currently, New York Times magazine.
That's right.
Say hello to us,
the stars.
The stars and
thanks
politicians
so
and most recently, Jackson Galaxy.
Who's dope as hell.
You got to interview Carrie Brownstein. I was so envious of you.
I cannot talk much more about that.
Wow. Okay, maybe I'm not envious of you. I always thought she was the coolest person in the world.
She is the coolest person, but I'll put it this way. I walked away from that hour-long interview feeling like she was... I still felt like she was much cooler than I am.
Mm.
We want to talk a little bit about the captain of our American garbage scow. Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Still pretty much leading in the polls. There have been a few tiny seismic shifts in certain polls. I think Ted Cruz got up on him in Iowa, and that caused him to unleash his latest riposte.
Right.
Which was to prevent Muslims and Muslim Americans from entering the country, which is kind of weird because there are a lot of Muslim Americans in the military.
He wound up saying, if you're in the military, that's okay.
Oh, good. Yeah, he said it was okay if it was his friends, too.
Did he say, you know, all his friends?
Yeah.
Right. So,
yeah. Meanwhile, I have at least one Muslim former colleague on the campaign trail and one Muslim colleague in our office who I think is hopefully coming back from Canada today and will make it into the United States. Anyway, this has been something of a turning point, I think, for all of us. People have been paying attention to the Huffington Post knows that we took our shot at not being a bystander in the Trump wars, and we missed the shot pretty badly.
Well, you tried. You guys tried, and I honor the attempt to not play the game that unfortunately gave Trump the foothold in our national consciousness, or second foothold, maybe, if you want to, in it. If you consider, okay, drop that metaphor. What happened with Trump, I think, and what the Huffington Post tried to not be a part of, was that before he became an actual campaign, which he is now— he was just a guy saying shit.
Yeah, basically.
And but the political media has no other way to cover someone besides as a candidate. Like, they treated him with the structure of campaign journalism and effectively turned him into a candidate when he was still just a guy who should have been like, do we cover everything Alex Jones says?
No.
Do we cover everything Rush Limbaugh says? Do we cover?
Yeah, we don't cover everything that Vermin Supreme says.
Right. So,
you know?
I mean,
I hate to make the comparison between a good man like Vermin Supreme and Donald Trump. Vermin, I apologize. You're welcome on our show anytime. You're a good man.
But because we have the structure of campaign journalism where you do, you know, on the one hand, on the other hand, we're going to treat his supporters. We're going to go out and interview people at his rallies. This box containing campaign, you know, got built, and then he put a campaign inside of it. Does that
and
you guys refuse and you guys were trying to not play that game to try not to have a part in the structure of that journalism.
Yeah, even though it kind of kneecapped us in a lot of different ways, we were willing to do that because we just didn't want to play any part of it. And unfortunately, we got we've all been dragged into it. I have to say that, like, to my mind, what I missed about Donald Trump, and you know, I'll never make this mistake again, assuming that norms are at work in the world. To me, Donald Trump was a celebrity. He belonged in the entertainment section. And I thought that he would still be bound by the certain kind of gravitational pull that keep all celebrities tethered somewhere in orbit. We don't always like celebrities. Some of them are manifest dicks. We have trouble with them, that do scandalous things. And yet, the goal of a celebrity is always to try to hit those four quadrants. That's how they make money. They hit four quadrants. So they have to maintain a certain level of reasonable access to what we would call goodwill, public goodwill. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump threw that aside and has run essentially, you know, a skinhead rally.
I think this is what has been hard for the political press to wrap their heads around is that Donald Trump has since he started running the campaign, whatever we want to call it, whether it was a real campaign at the beginning or not, since he started talking and saying that he was running for president, he's essentially been running. I think I wrote a column about this in our entertainment section a few months ago, saying that he was a plutocrat populist from hell. But that was actually a nice way of saying he was running as a very traditional fascist demagogue. Mm-hmm. And it has now become really clear that he's just saying, let's discriminate against people who are Muslim. Don't even let them into the country. I mean, it's very clear that that's the playbook that he's going by. And that's not a playbook that Americans are used to seeing in our politics, but it's something that's become very common in Europe over the last, frankly, the last decade, but was also very common in Europe 50 years ago. And it's a common response to economic downturns, that people get angry, and this is one way to exploit that anger. And I feel like the constant discussion in the political media between insider candidates and outsider candidates really elides that there's a different distinction that's going on. And in fact, all of the other Republican candidates are making a play for the same vote and trying to harness that same anger. They just don't want to look as mean and petty as Donald Trump does when they do that.
Right.
I think that's been you watch the campaign, and it's you see people, like, you know, Morning Joe making a big show about Donald Trump, about shutting down Donald Trump the other day
for at least a commercial break. They totally just didn't let him talk through a commercial break.
Right. And they were willing to admit that Starbucks and Coca-Cola meant more to them than Donald Trump did in that one slim instance.
Capitalism will win out.
But then you watch MSNBC for the rest of the day, and they're playing that clip over and over and over and over again. You know, you don't defeat somebody like Donald Trump with good arguments and good put-downs. Like, that doesn't work. People like him because he's a guy who gets on TV and gets to say stuff. That's it. That's the appeal.
And also, he benefits from the ready-made narrative that the liberal media just lies and makes up stuff and is against him, right? Like, that, like, I think he is a beneficiary of the dysfunctional political conversation we've been having for the last 20 years, you know, because he gets to go to that ready-made narrative that they already believe that the liberal media is out to get him.
And he gets to exploit the fact that the media is so often a bystander. You know, he makes these outrageous comments about banning Muslims from entering the country. And cable news response is to say,
tell us what your cable news.
So Donald Trump says this, but we've heard of this thing called a constitution. Now to talk about the constitution is a guy from Harvard Law School. Tell us about this constitution.
This is what fucking pissed me off so much all the time.
The Don Lemoning of all news.
Well, that, and also, like, it's not a fucking plan or a policy to ban Muslims. Right? Like, that's just a fucking, like, taking a shit on the Constitution. Like, that's not, like, you know what I mean? A policy is something you can enact, you know?
Well, and you've seen this with the way he sort of walks it back, like, oh, yeah, I'd let my friends come in, as you pointed out.
To call it a policy dignifies it in a way that, like, in the same way that having to go to a constitutional expert to get a quote about it, which is, if Kelly Ripa tried to get Donald Trump to talk about the constitutionality of his argument. She's not, as far as I know, a constitutional scholar, but she seemed to recognize inherently that there was a problem with this
religious test.
He shouldn't be allowed on the air. Like, we don't.
And you see, even then we stray into territory where, are we censoring him? It's really difficult. He's created a difficult problem.
And we are now, to be clear, we are now covering him as a politics figure at the Huffington Post.
I regret that we kind of Deshaun Jacksoned our shot.
I mean, the problem is that covering him as entertainment for us, I think at first it was okay when he was just saying outrageous things and insulting other Republican candidates. I mean, he would say, like, I've had it up to here with Rand Paul, and, like, hold his hand up to, like, his shoulder and be like, haha, Rand Paul is short. All right, I got it. Like, all right. Entertainment.
Right.
But when he's doing openly fascist demagoguery and talking about religious tests for Americans, it's not entertaining anymore. And there's got to be some way to denounce that and acknowledge that it's happening and acknowledge that people in the public sphere are responding to it in some way, which is probably the most frightening part of it.
I think maybe one thing to do is to do what you to repeat and amplify a point that you made earlier, which is that we've seen this in Europe. We've seen the rise of the fascist right in Europe as a political force.
Yeah.
And that is what has happening here. And that he's also not metaphorically at all. He is doing ISIS's, you know, bidding.
Basically, yes.
Like, this is what ISIS wants from the West. They want
to leave Muslims with no choice but the caliphate.
That is exactly right. Yeah. You guys probably, you should have on, if you haven't already had on, Will McCants. He's a Brookings Institute scholar on ISIS. He covers their social media. He covers their propaganda. Like, he's been sending me, like, tweets from ISIS members that cite, you know, things that the people on the right in Europe have said. And he says he hasn't yet seen it on the message boards, like, people talking about Trump. But that's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Right. No.
Like, literally, some ISIS member is going to do, like, a GIF of Donald Trump on whatever, you know, ISIS Reddit there is. Like, I don't really know what they have.
I think it's called Reddit.
Yeah, you know?
Yeah.
And it'll be proof that, you know, yeah, you have no choice. You're not wanted in the West. You know.
You have to come home to the death to cult. The ISIS paradise and learn to live with us. It's not always easy for... It's a terrible thing to have done. It's a really terrible thing to have done for a lot of different reasons, not the least of which is that we desperately need to attract some kind of Sunni proxy group to help us fight ISIS. And when you're talking like Donald Trump, it doesn't exactly endear people to us. In fact, a lot of people on the ground in Iraq think that we and ISIS are in cahoots. So there's a whole thorny mess to get through. He's not helping.
Yeah.
It's going to be, I got to tell you, it's like right now it's like being in a world with no gravity. Every time I see him in a debate, it's a little bit like watching a hallucination. Like, mm-hmm. I can't really fathom what's going on. And it's because, like I said before, I'm used to a certain amount of norms.
There's this way in which the cultural conversation that we have around politics has just become much, much more toxic. That was not something that I honestly expected to happen. I thought he was going to be a much more potent candidate than people were giving him credit for early on, because he was running by a fascist playbook that was working in other parts of the world. But I did not expect the just general toxicity of the way we talk about politics and about each other as human beings in the United States to be degraded this far. I mean, this is a basic part of the Republican messaging now. And the Democrats are going around on their high horse like, look, we don't like Trump. We're so great. Like that's an amazing achievement.
I agree.
To stick with this topic just through the end, I want to ask, maybe it's an important question that you're alluding to, is Donald Trump has said a lot of things that we've called outrageous, we've called flamboyant. I would make the case, and there's not a lot of Republicans going to appreciate me saying this, but I would make the case that he's invented very little in the conversation. He's perhaps wrapped it in different packaging, but I don't tend to disassociate. We've had candidates talk about banning Muslims. We've had candidates talk about building walls. We have candidates talk about deporting Mexicans. And I tend to think, and I'm sorry to say this, but I tend to think a lot of the candidates' responses to Donald Trump on the right is not so much, you were wrong and here's why. It is, what you just said makes us look terrible.
Yeah. Oh, that's completely what it is. And I'm not breaking news to anyone who's you know, savvy enough to be listening to this podcast, but Ted Cruz explicitly, you know, decided not to go after him. Rand Paul went after him only to say, well, I also suggested something very similar. You know, but not as bad somehow,
right?
You know, and Ted Cruz basically also has the same thing. He says that we should let in Christians, which is the same thing as banning.
Right. It's still a religious test.
It's a religious test. It's the same thing.
Ben Carson said, you know, compared Syrian refugees to rabid dogs. I mean
Ben Carson also said, we need something that vets everyone coming into the country. And I was like, Ben, it's called the fucking customs agency. We've had it for a long time. You need to get a fucking grip, Ben Carson, and learn about something, anything. It's called the fucking customs. Look it up. Wikipedia, that shit. Anyway, to me, I don't know. It's
I am completely, this is, you know, I've been covering politics for a long time, longer than I care to figure out. And I do feel like this is the first time I've felt at a loss. You know, I think this is what you say, you feel like you're having an hallucination. I wrote early on something that I guess I will, I'm not especially proud to say, I think is still relevant, which is that what Trump is doing is, some people had said early on that maybe Trump would have a hot mic moment that would undo him, like sort mm-hmm. of a face in the crowd
right.
moment. But that's not going to happen because he doesn't censor himself. There's no other side of him to see. Like he has a hot mic on all the time. Like he lives hot
constantly
mic.
Constantly happening. Yeah.
Right? The problem is who's having the hot mic moment in this period is actually the media, because we don't know what to do. And we're having to sort of say out loud all this stuff about the process that normally we would be doing without thinking. And so the public is getting to see a lot of the flaws in political coverage, and it's not making them trust us anymore.
No. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, life is pain.
So that's what happened this week. This podcast was produced, edited, and engineered by Adriano Ocero and Peter James Callahan, with technical assistance from Christine Canetta and spiritual guidance from Golden Globe nominee Caitlin Bogucki. I'm Jason Linkins. This week we were joined by podcaster and writer Anna Marie Cox and Wisconsin Congressman Reed Ribble, as well as Huffington Post reporters Zach Carter, Arthur Delaney, Samantha Lachman, and Shaheen Nazirapour. So That Happened is available on iTunes at itunes.com/sothathappened. Check out the whole family of Huffington Post podcasts in the iTunes store while you're there. Subscribe and tell your friends. If there's something you'd like to hear us talk about, send an email to sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. As always, thanks for listening, and we miss you already.